The Guardian.
This is the Guardian Books Podcast from the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
This podcast is completely gothic. It's going to be really scary. Starring Kevin McNeill, Richard T. Kelly, Karen Russell and Lewis Welch.
Scariest book I've ever read. 1984, I guess, by George Orwell. Yeah, right when I was a young guy, and it completely fazed me. Yeah.
There's a book by Ken MacLeod called The Highwaymen, which is based in the Highlands in the kind of near future. That book scared me because it made me kind of think Mother Nature is far stronger than us, and I had hope that science could save the world, but I really don't think it will.
The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper, which is a children's book, and it's spine-tinglingly terrifying. Bad things happen in the middle of the night in a deep snowfall, and it really freaks me out still.
Something about the set dressing of Edinburgh. Just the minute I came in last night in the twilight and started stealing through the streets, I began to feel, the cloak of Hyde wasn't so far away anymore. It is atmospheric, there's no question about it.
Two British authors bringing the Gothic novel bang up to date are here in Edinburgh. The Possessions of Dr. Forrest by Richard T. Kelly centres around three childhood friends, now respected middle-aged doctors. When Dr. Forrest goes missing, his friends are drawn into their own investigations and find themselves caught in a web of deceit, menace and finally, fatality. Kevin McNeill's A Method Actor's Guide to Jekyll and Hyde riffs on Robert Louis Stevenson's classic novel. The eponymous actor is taking on both sides of Stevenson's character. But after a bike accident in foggy Edinburgh, he begins to lose his grip on his work, his love life and his mind. Richard and Kevin, the world is so well lit now and there are so few dark corners. Doesn't it feel as if Gothic literature is a bit of an anachronism these days?
Not at all, and it never will be, because the dark corners are in the human mind and they will always be there. They're part of our identity. Let's not forget, even in the Jekyll and Hyde story, Jekyll himself is not unalloyed good. He's an admixture of good and slightly less good, which is what we are as flawed, normal human beings.
I see the world more as a black hole all the time, really, so the Gothic is very much, my shadow in life. I think the Gothic lives everywhere. It's in the architecture of our cities. It's in any one of us who feels the shape of other people inside ourselves, which is quite a common neurosis, I think. And as long as there are teenagers in this country, there'll be Gothic, black-clad kids walking down the streets keeping the spirit alive.
You both cite Jekyll and Hyde as a big influence in your work, but Richard, you mentioned in your event a bit earlier on Dracula and Frankenstein as well, and all of these books feature doctors. Do you think there's a reason why doctors are such a big deal in Gothic fiction?
I think doctors have a certain kind of power in our society. We do see them as inspirational figures, magus figures, prophets and priests to some extent. We rely on them in our greatest times of crisis. But also we can be suspicious of them. I mean, the scientists of Gothic literature, Dr. Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and so forth, they are often figures who are seen to be tampering with human nature and with what our bodies are or should be.
And do you think we still have that fear nowadays?
Oh, good Lord. I mean, my book is a supernatural book, but you could do a Gothic today about stem cells or gene therapy or cosmetic surgery, which is in my book. But yeah, the science of changing our bodies, that's a huge source of anxiety and fear and excitement in the present day, absolutely.
And Kevin, we're here in Edinburgh, which is where your novel is set, and I know you lived here for quite a long time. Is location a really important thing in Gothic literature, do you think?
Oh, I think so. And Edinburgh itself. I believe that the London of Stevenson's Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is actually, in all but name, Stevenson's own native Edinburgh. Mm. Now, Edinburgh is a very, very clearly divided city. There's the old town and there's the new town. And Stevenson himself, when he was a young man going about in his velvet coat, frequenting low-down pubs and consorting with ladies of the night and so forth, he, shall we say, experimented with both sides of Edinburgh. But I think you could take that further and say that all cities, certainly all the cities that I've ever visited, from Medellin in Colombia to London, where I now live, they're all divided. They all have this kind of polarisation. We've seen it very recently in the Troubles in London come to life. And I think location in Gothic literature, it's one of the kind of staples of the Gothic style. And doing it in a contemporary context offers a lot of quite fun potential, because you can do it in a very knowing manner.
You talk about the two sides that Edinburgh has and the two sides that all cities have. And that feeds into the idea of duality, which again is central to Gothic fiction. Can you talk to me a bit about that?
Yes. Robert Louis Stevenson's central premise in his Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is that man is not truly one, but two. Even excusing this slightly sexist parlance of the day, I'm not sure I fully agree with that. What I wanted to do was take a different tack. I explored not just duality, but multiplicity and then unity. My premise behind this novel is that there is no such thing as a fixed, unchanging self, which anybody with a knowledge of Buddhism listening will know that that's a central tenet of Buddhist thinking.
We've talked a bit about classic novels of Gothic fiction. What are the novels around now? Who are the writers around now, apart from you two, obviously, who are really doing great things in this genre?
I look at people like Louise Welsh as a good example. Actually, most of the modern writers to whom I look for as real exemplars of great contemporary or near contemporary Gothic are female. And for me, Angela Carter would certainly be up there. I think she was a really powerfully influential and wonderful writer in this context.
Yeah, I would make a claim for Carter. Also for Emma Tennant, who's revisited the Gothic in books like Faustine and Two Women of London. Patrick McGrath, wonderful writer whose work is entirely impregnated by that Gothic spirit. Charles Palliser also, I think, the Quincunx was a novel that was very instrumental in reviving the spirit of Victorian literature in the present day.
You are both Northern writers, and Richard, you said that thing about having two sides to your personality being a requirement of residence in Scotland. Do you think it's anything to do with the dark and light of growing up in the North, where you have these really long winters and really light summers, and that kind of creates that split personality in people?
I think that's an element of it, because if you live on an island and if you live in the far north, you're much more aware of the darkness than the light, because there's so much of it and there's a lot of greyness, and sometimes it's very far indeed from a 50-50 split of light and dark. Summer can be over almost in an afternoon or in a week in Scotland generally. I think it's very likely that there is a connection there, yeah.
Edinburgh Castle, town and tour. God grant thou sink for sin, and that even for the Black Dinoir, Earl Douglas gat therein.
I'm Zan Brooks, and I've come to the black heart of Gothic Edinburgh, to Mary King's Close off the High Street. Outside it's lively and bustling, but now we're two flights down a set of worn stone steps. It's damp and dark and silent as the grave. I'm here with Louise Welsh, whose forensic debut novel The Cutting Room was nominated for the Orange Prize in 2003, and whose last tale, Naming the Bones, similarly digs beneath the surface of Scottish culture. Louise, why are we here?
Oh, I think this is one of my favourite places in Edinburgh. And when I was a child, we were told stories about plague victims who'd been walled up and left to die. They didn't go quietly. They cried and screamed and begged for food, but people were so frightened of the plague that they wouldn't let them out. And this is, of course, all utter nonsense. And the real Mary King's Close, the organisation here, are very eager to dispel all of these myths, and they've based their tours on a very solid historical research. And yet, as you say, we're two floors under. It's dark, it's damp, so yes, it's creepy. And I think we're going to take a wee tour and find out some of the creepier corners.
Okay, we're in a very, this is a very creepy spectacle here. We've just come into a very small room with undressed walls. There's an alcove, and in the alcove, there's what I can only describe as a sort of tweeny voodoo shrine in which a lot of children's dolls are piled to the height of about 5 foot into the alcove. So there's dolls, there's Smurfs, there's teddy bears, there's stuffed rabbits. And it's peculiarly terrifying in a way. Louise, what on earth is this?
Dolls are creepy, aren't they? There's hundreds of eyes looking at you. This is a shrine. This is an unofficial, spontaneous shrine to little Annie. And I think in the early 90s, a Japanese parapsychologist or medium came down here, and she claimed to have felt the presence of a little girl called Annie, who she said was desperately missing her parents. Her mummy had left her down here because she had the plague, apparently. Annie wanted a doll. She'd also lost her doll. and this is the result. This hundreds of dolls. Last time I was down here, there were cigarettes as well. They seem to have all gone. I should say I believe in none of this, but I'm fascinated by the sight of these dolls. And you're right, really creepy. And this is typically gothic, actually, isn't it? The idea of the inanimate may somehow suddenly become animate.
No, the rabbit is definitely, it's giving me the evil eye. Some people have left messages as well. Here's one in, I guess, a sort of childish hand. To Annie and all the other little children who are here. Love from Rebecca Coverley. I'm not sure what other little children are here, but I'm hoping we don't run into them on the stairwell. This is actually very unpleasant. And although obviously done with heart and good intentions, the paradoxical effect is to scare the wits out of somebody who comes into this room.
You go under dark arches and down dark stairs and alleys. The way is so narrow that you can lay a hand on either wall. So steep that in the greasy winter weather, the pavement is almost as treacherous as ice.
We may have found Annie, I'm not sure. There's a bed in this vaulted room with a model of a girl, not a real girl, I hasten to add, lying in a sick bed with a hooded figure with his or her back to us, bending over her. It looks like the Grim Reaper to me. Whereabouts are we walking? What is this labyrinth of stairwells and passageways and these little vaulted rooms? What were they used for, and then how did they kind of fall out of existence for a while?
So these were people's homes, people's shops, people's streets, and basically they fell out of use because of new planning. They wanted to build a big trades hall on top of it. The people were moved out, but the streets and the houses remained, and they were left unused for about 200 years until the 30s, when these were used for storage and for bomb shelters during the Second World War. And there's an idea that this has been rediscovered, that these are streets that were lost and have now been reclaimed. That isn't actually quite right. People always knew that they were there. And I wonder if that's part of the reason that the myths of them have sprung up, because we knew that they were there. But until quite recently, until I think this tour started off in the 90s, until then, most of us didn't get the opportunity to go down. So it's a realist, well-established tourist attraction now. But when I was a child, this was a myth.
Now, we're assured that we're being led out of here now, although we seem to be going further and further down, so maybe we've been sold apart. I can understand if you were thinking that the bombs were falling, that you'd want somewhere safe, but at the same time, I can imagine people being fairly unsettled coming down here during the Second World War, and it's a real case of devil and deep blue sea, I suppose, and it's a place steeped in history and not altogether pleasant history, but it's a fascinating place, and I'm very glad that we're now on our way out. We're now at the fire door. Hamish, our tour guide, has thrown the bolt on the fire door, and there's an explosion of light, and I can see a pub, and I've never liked the sight of a pub more. And we're out into lit, rainy Edinburgh again.
The Great Hotel is given over to discomfort from the foundation to the chimney tops. Everywhere, a pinching, narrow habit, scanty meals and an air of sluttishness and dirt. In the first room, there is a birth. In another, a death. In a third, a sordid drinking bout. And the detective and the Bible reader cross on the stairs.
We're outside. The rain is now falling pretty hard, but it's okay because we found a pub. It's Deacon Brodie's Tavern. There's a very nice sign outside. It looks very inviting. One side of the sign shows Deacon Brodie and he looks lovely. But then you walk around the other side and he looks rather less lovely. And suddenly the pub doesn't look quite as inviting as it did before. Louise, explain to me who Deacon Brodie was.
That's great. It's the best accolade you can have, isn't it? To have a pub named after you. That's really what I'm aiming for. They can keep their honours, their knighthoods and their damehoods. I want a bar in my name. Deacon Brodie is one of the great myths, one of the great legends of Edinburgh. He was a deacon. That means he was a respected character. He was a cabinet maker. and yet by night he was a thief, and he used his privileges as a cabinet maker in order to make keys to work out the locks of the richest people in Edinburgh, and by night he would go around his frolics. The deacon was discovered. He was hung on the same gallows that he himself had imported into the city. And this meant, of course, that lots of legends built up around him. Did the deacon die or did he manage to escape? And there are all sorts of stories about him having a metal tube put down his throat, about the hangman taking him away very, very quickly. There were sightings of him as far away as Paris. And the deacon died in 1788, and this idea of him being an exciting, heroic figure lives on in the legend, and they say that his final words before he stepped from the gallows were, "What is it but a leap in the dark?" And stories about Deacon Brodie fascinated the young Robert Louis Stevenson. There was a chest in Robert Louis Stevenson's house that was reputed to have been made by Deacon Brodie. You can still see it in the Writers' Museum in Lady Stair's Close. And as a boy, Stevenson would make stories around this chest. Much later on, he was to write a very successful book, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And the double life of Deacon Brodie lives on in this book, I think.
People hush their voices over Burke and Hare, over drugs and violated graves, and the resurrection men smothering people with their knees.
Here we are now at the Surgeon's Hall Museum, in a handsome terrace on a discreet square, up a flight of marble staircases. But inside, under glass, we have skulls and skeletons and the mummified corpse of children. Louise, where do all these bodies, where do they come from?
We're looking at the death mask of William Burke. And William's Burke and his cohort, William Hare, are famous as the body snatchers. At this point, there's a shortage of bodies. There's a lot of private anatomy skills, but there's not enough bodies to anatomise. And so if you can bring along a fairly fresh corpse, you can get some money for it. William's Burke and Hare supply corpses to Dr. Robert Knox at Surgeon's Hall. And they're not satisfied with just digging them up as other resurrection men were reputed to have done. They actually murdered their victims. They murdered 17 victims before they were discovered. And there's a massive trial in 1828. William Burke is found guilty and hung, partly because William Hare turns evidence against him. Dr. Robert Knox, the surgeon, is left untouched. Robert Louis Stevenson writes very well about this in a short story, The Body Snatcher. And what fascinates him, I think, again, is the hypocrisy of a system that leaves Knox alone and yet makes Burke, right enough, he's a murderer, but he is the only one that carries the can. His skeleton is in Edinburgh University. In front of us, we have this death mask. It could be a man that you might meet in the street outside here, a very normal-looking man. In front of him is a pocketbook made from the skin of William Burke after his corpse was cut down. I could imagine picking that up in a second-hand bookshop and getting no frisson of disgust from it. It looks very normal. They're a real part of the legend of the city. And we've got a wee rhyme here. Down the close and up the stair, Button Ben with Burke and Hare, Burke the butcher, Hare the thief, and Knox the boy that buys the beef. And I think that sums it up. Suzanne, you said you're a wee bit squeamish. How are you feeling surrounded by hearts and lungs and foot that have the veins exposed? These wee skeletons here sitting beside the plaster cast of Dr. Knox.
I think my relationship with anything medical, hospitals or whatever, is a squeamishness about the mixture of sterility and the horror of bones or blood or people in pain. Or we've got a lot of medical utensils, antique medical utensils lying around that look like, you know, the Inquisition torture instruments. Now these things are all supposedly domesticated and safely put away behind glass, but weirdly that makes them all the more kind of pregnant with meaning and horror.
This is a major thing in the Gothic, isn't it? This idea of invading our body, not just the bodies that get up, but actually the idea that our body might get invaded, and the mistrust of science as well. These people know an awful lot more than we do but can we trust them with that knowledge? And in Knox's case, I think people felt, no, we can't. This man, not just buying dead bodies, but is somehow complicit in the murder of these bodies as well. So this fear of science is something that that goes throughout Gothic literature.
The ancient teachers of science promised impossibilities and performed nothing. The modern masters promise very little. They know that metals cannot be transmuted and that the elixir of life is a chimera. But these philosophers, whose hands seem only to dabble in dirt and their eyes to pore over microscope or crucible, have indeed performed miracles. They penetrate into the recesses of nature and show how she works in her hiding places. They ascend into the heavens. They have discovered how the blood circulates and the nature of the air we breathe. They have acquired new and almost unlimited powers. They can command the thunders of heaven, mimic the earthquake, and even mock the invisible world with its own shadows.
Our tour is almost over, and I guess I should have known at the start that it would end here, among the graves where all things end. We're in the Greyfriars Kirkyard, and we're by a very unusual grave that's covered with basically a kind of iron grill. And this is the iron malt safe, and the caption explains, "The iron malt safe was placed over the grave to prevent grave robbers from digging up the body for sale to the anatomy classes of the medical school." So what would happen is you would be guaranteed peaceful rest, at least until your body had rotted safely. Louise, tell me about where we are here.
As you said, we're in Greyfriars Kirkyard, really in the heart of the city of Edinburgh, and there are many great and good authors buried here. Sir Walter Scott, no stranger to the Gothic himself. We think James Hogg's here, author of Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, a huge influence on Stevenson later on. Somebody else that I'm interested in here is Dr. John Polidori, who studied somnambulism at the University of Edinburgh, an associate of the well-known Aberdonian Lord George Byron, associate of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley as well. And we can just almost see bits of the medical department of Edinburgh University where Polidori would have studied. He's interesting because he's the author of The Vampire, the very first book about the dead that walk. It stars at its centre Lord Ruthven, who is a man who is fascinating in equal measure to men and to women. And Lord Ruthven is a And I guess it brings in another strand of the Gothic we've not talked about yet, sexuality, and this idea of crossing other taboos as well. Polidori is a huge influence on Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. He's present on the same evening at the Villa Diodati that Mary Shelley, we think, begins to write Frankenstein. There's a possibility, we don't know, but there's a possibility that Polidori may have spoken to her about experiments that are being done at Edinburgh University at that point, and galvanisation, the idea that if we take a corpse quickly enough and shoot it full of electricity, we might just be able to bring the dead back to life.
How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe? Or how delineate the wretch with whom such infinite pain and care I had endeavoured to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes, that seemed almost the same colour as the dun-white sockets in which they were set.
Louise Welsh with Zan Brooks. I'm Karen Russell. I'm the author of the recent novel Swamplandia, which uses Gothic conventions but sets them in the humid clime of South Florida.
So here in the UK, we're used to thinking of Gothic as a sort of northern urban tradition coming out of the darkness that lurks in the corners of twilight cities. But there is a strong tradition of Southern Gothic in the US, isn't there?
There definitely is, and a very influential one. I think a lot of writers coming up now cut their teeth on Faulkner, and Flannery O'Connor is, you know, canonical and much beloved in the States. And I think that Southern Gothic really focuses on freaks and misfits and is sort of Christ-haunted in a way that I don't always associate with Northern Gothic.
Yes, it has this sort of religious component, doesn't it, that we don't particularly think of when we're thinking of more Northern Gothic.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm thinking of Flannery O'Connor here, who's, you know, all of her stuff is sort of blood-soaked, very influenced by her Catholicism.
Yeah.
Obviously Faulkner, too. So I think that that might be one distinction. And they all follow a very similar arc, right, where it is violent action on a character produces a moment of grace or some kind of epiphany or some sort of break in their psyche or structure. So I think that that is ingrained in me as story arc. And then I think somebody who I really doubt I could have written this book if I hadn't been reading is Catherine Dunn. And I don't know that she's sort of more contemporary than Flannery, and she had this book in the 80s, Geek Love, that is very grotesque. It's about a family of carnival freaks. So I think what those guys did for me is really extend my idea of what fiction could be, that you could have literary fiction that also focused on eccentric or freakish characters, yeah, that was sort of larger than life, played with fantasy and reality, had supernatural elements, but was still, you know, those writers are also highly lyrical in addition to being sort of way out there. Mm. So that was, it was great for me to read them.
Let's talk a bit about the physical landscape of the book, because again, when we're thinking of Northern Gothic literature, we think of a sort of a shadowy, almost attenuated landscape of bricks and mortar and dark corners, whereas the landscape that you're writing about is, it's dark but in a different way. It's sort of standing water and vines and swamp and mud. I wondered whether it was difficult to write about sort of dark and haunting things in a landscape that was lit by full sun.
I do think that's always so funny about Southern Gothic, because you kind of picture, right, Gothic as being this shadowy, frightening. My friend and I were joking recently. She was like, Southern Goth, is that just girls? They wear all black and they live in North Carolina. They sweat a lot. You know, it does seem sort of incongruous with palm trees. You don't necessarily think Gothic. Miami is so far south that it's almost Latin American in some senses. It's not quite Southern in the sense of Carson and Flannery. But the swamp itself, you could not ask for a more Gothic landscape in some ways. I mean, it is a sublime landscape, I think, in the truest sense of that word. And it's absolutely uncanny. It's almost Freud's uncanny, you know, but in geographic terms, it's not really land or water. You can't get your bearings there. There is, in the same way that the castles are all, like, you know, decaying on the hill, the swamp is a place of sort of, you know, post-Edenic continual decay, all kinds of nutrients breaking down, and these, you know, mangrove roots that really look sort of like some underworld labyrinth.
So metaphorically, it's just a gift, isn't it?
It's too much. It's sort of annoyingly pregnant, you know? I mean, it's the swamp itself became a character.
You've mentioned Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner, novelists like that, and they are also exponents of the fact that Southern Gothic often has this sort of social and political side to it, that it's exploring social and political issues, you know, race in particular, that aren't, you know, necessarily issues that come up again in Northern Gothic. And I wondered whether those are things that you considered in the writing of your book.
Those writers are using those conventions to explore black-white racial tensions, African-American white racial tensions. And in Miami, it's sort of a different scene. I think the book ends up dealing a little bit with that, only insofar as the big trees are these alligator wrestlers, and they exist way off the grid. And in a way, their story is sort of an immigrant story. They end up moving back from nature to the mainland, which is sort of like a whacked out version of Miami. I think it's rare to find someone who lives there who goes back more than one generation. It's this totally heterogeneous place, and you have, you know, Cuban, Haitian, Dominican, just waves of immigrants. That was exciting narratively because it's a pathless place, you know. I think that's another.
But what it does have, which comes up in your book, is ghosts.
Yes.
And, you know, again, obviously that's to do with history, but also to do with landscape a lot of the time. Exactly. And I wondered where they'd all sprung from.
Yeah, those ghosts. I think that all the characters in the book are haunted. They've lost their mother. But I think that it's part of what's so traumatic about that loss for them is that they are very rootless. You know, they don't actually have a long-standing tradition in the swamp. And most people that they're meeting, you know, the Cuban immigrants that go to school with Kiwi or the residents of on the mainland, are either tourists who kind of like ebb and flow, you know, they come in on the tides, or they're people that haven't really been in South Florida for very long. So the ghosts, I think there's this real longing for history. And I also just think ghosts are wonderful as an alphabet to talk about. I don't know anybody alive who's not haunted by someone or something, you know, by something without substance that determines their actions or you know, a longing that consumes them. And they're fun. It's just fun to write a ghost story.
Okay, Karen, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you, Sarah. This was great.
And that's all the Gothic books we can fit into one podcast.
In Monday's show, we'll be looking at Revolution. The presenter was Sarah Crown.
And the producer is Ian Chambers. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.